Okay, here we go. Parshas Naso. Let's first start by setting the scene, okay, where there's a number of different halachas that are found in Parshas Naso. And before we begin to create a thematic connection between the various bodies of law in Naso, we have to kind of go back. Last week we weren't here to introduce Sefer Bamidbar and kind of describe what we expect to find in the whole Sefer Bamidbar, and then focus on the specific, interesting, very unique, one-of-a-kind halachos that are found in this week's Parsha. There's an assortment of different laws. So Sefer Bamidbar is obviously after Vayikra. What happens is, let's jump back a little bit. Sefer Shemos, the Bnei Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim. They stood around Har Sinai. They heard the Dibros. Moshe went up. He came down. It was Cheda Egel. He broke the Luchos. Okay? Then he went back up to ask for forgiveness, and it took 80 days and came down with second Luchos. But in the meantime, because of the sin, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had moved his Shechina outside of the camp. And Moshe moved his own tent outside of the camp. In other words, the Shechina no longer could reside among Klal Yisrael, being that they had sinned by, in a sense, violating the fundamental bond, which is to relate only to Hashem directly. So then, in order to restore the Shechina back into the Machaneh, Hashem told them, that there would be a way to do this, build a Mishkan. If you build a Mishkan and you do it all correctly, then Hashem Shechina will come back from Michutz L'Machaneh, from outside of the camp, and dwell amongst you in the camp. And the rest of Sefer Shemos is devoted to the laws of the building of the Mishkan. And then once the Mishkan is built, you go into the entire Sefer Vayikra, all kinds of rules of all sorts relating to the Kedusha of the Mishkan, the Kedusha of the Machaneh because there's a Mishkan in the center of it, the Kedusha of the Kohanim, the Kedusha of the Levium, the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael, Kedusha of the food, the Karbanos, everything pertaining to the Kedusha that now pervades Klal Yisrael, being that Hashem Shechina returned, and that applies to people being aware of their status of Kedusha. We spoke about that, right? Tumentara. Kedusha of the place, and all kinds of restrictions and cautionary measures when you approach the place where the Kedusha is most visible or experienced. And that's all of Sefer Vayikra. And now that that's complete, almost complete, we turn to Sefer Bamidbar. So Bamidbar starts with the Sefer, where there is a census of Klal Yisrael, again, and then the arrangement of the camp around the Mishkan in preparation to travel towards Eretz Yisrael. So we would expect now to proceed with the final necessary arrangements for Klal Yisrael to proceed towards Eretz Yisrael. Don't forget, after the Cheda Egel, when Hashem moved his Shechina away, he also said to Klal Yisrael that he's going to deposit them. Remember, after the Cheda Egel, he said, I'm going to deposit them in Eretz Yisrael, because even though I've moved my Shechina away, and they're no longer my nation. This is prior to the tshuva. He said that, but I still have an obligation based on a promise I made to the Avos to bring them to Eretz Yisrael. So I will bring them to Eretz Yisrael. A Malach will take them, and then I'm putter. But then when Moshe petitioned for tshuva, for forgiveness, Hashem said, fine, this is what you have to do. You have to build a Mishkan. Then my Shechina will return. And if my Shechina will return to them, then they will be my chosen nation one more time. And then I will bring them to Eretz Yisrael the way I originally planned, not to drop them off there and be putter from them, but to continue being their personal God in Eretz Yisrael. So now they're ready for this, and they're about to proceed in Eretz Yisrael. So you would, as we said, expect to find the final arrangements to bring them in Eretz Yisrael. And you do. You find that in the beginning of Bamidbar. But then in Naso, you find some laws that don't seem to have anything to do with this and could have easily been, we think, located in Vayikra with all the other laws of the Mishkan. And these are the following laws you're going to find in Sefer Naso, in Parshas Naso. Turn to page 750. Okay. The 748, the beginning of the parsha, is the last countings of the children of Levi, Gershon, Kahath, and Merari, okay? The last of the countings of the Levium that are going to do the Avodah and the Mishkan. And then Perek Hei and Naso starts with the following laws. We call that Shiluach Tameim, okay? The laws of having the Tamei people travel at the outskirts of the camp, okay? They're Mechutz L'machaneh. That's number one. That makes sense. That seems to belong here for the time they're Tamei, which is a temporary period, and we've talked about Tumah. And then you get three different laws. You get the laws, four different sets of laws. You get Gezel Hager. Seems to have absolutely nothing to do with traveling to Eretz Yisrael. So look in Pasuk Hei, and it says, tell B'nai Yisrael that a woman or man that will sin. Now, it doesn't say specifically what the sin is, but there are catchphrases here that are similar to what we already heard about in another place, so we know what this is talking about. A person sins lim'ol ma'al b'Hashem. Now, a me'ila is when you use something not for its intended purpose, or you take something that is designated for the Mishkan, like a carbon, and you use it for your personal private pleasure. That's called a me'ila. It's a very specific kind of sin where you misuse something that is dedicated to something else, okay? So here, when it talks about a person being ma'al, b'Hashem, b'ashma, ha'nefesh ahi, and that soul is guilty because they've committed treachery, we know that this means that specific case, so it's not necessarily specified here, we're talking about a person that has been asked and has agreed to watch the valuables of another person, and then they claim that they have no one else's valuables in their possession, everything they have is their own. In other words, it's a form of gezel, robbery, and they deny that they have something in their possession that belongs to another person. And furthermore, it's called Gezel Hager, because the situation is that yuvehisvadu eschatasam, what they need to do is they have to admit vidoy the sin, the heshev es hashamo barosho, and they have to return, okay, make restitution for the what they're guilty of, in other words, the principal amount that they are guilty of, the chamishiso yosef alav, and add a fifth to the principal amount, and give it back to the person that they are guilty of, to who they are indebted to. Now, the reason it's called Gezel Hager is, as you'll see, that if the person is no longer alive, they have to give it to their relatives. But if that person has absolutely no relatives, they have to bring it to the Kohen. So this has something to do with the Mishkan, again. Now, who is the person that has absolutely no relatives at all, period, zero? We're talking about a ger. A ger was no halachic relatives, so then the money has to go to the Kohen. Okay, so this whole section is called Gezel Hager. Okay, because it says, Vim ein le'ish goel, person has no redeemer to return the indebted amount to, you give it to the Kohen. Okay? And everything that they give to the Kohen is the Kohen's. That's the rule. So the question is, what is Gezel Hager doing here? Okay? I mean, it has a connection to the Mishkan, in that you have to bring the money to the Mishkan, but it doesn't directly relate to the last operations prior to going to Eretz Yisrael, okay? So we are going to discuss this in depth and in a more philosophical type of way. What is Gezel Hager really referring to on a deeper level? Of course, it's a pshat level, it's a halacha, but it has, as all things do, much deeper ramifications. Then the next issue is the sota. Now, we have spoken about sota in the past a lot. Notice that the same terminology is used, okay? Look in Pasuk. Now, it's from the man's perspective. This is about the man, the husband. Ish, any man. Ki tiste ishto, if his wife goes astray. Uma'ala bo ma'al, same terminology. Ma'ala bo ma'al, and acted treacherously against him. A me'ila, she used something that is designated for something specific, something kodesh, for the wrong use, okay? She has misused something, just like the person who has taken someone else's valuables, agreed to watch them, and claims they're theirs, and used them for their own pleasure, okay? He has betrayed, so to speak, acted treacherously. So here, too, she has taken something and misused it, And that is her husband's, her loyalty to her husband. Now, let's just remind everybody, we're not going to go into it in depth, we've done it before. What are the conditions of the sota? Okay? It's a very rare and unusual halacha, and again, what is it doing here, right before they're about to travel in Eretz Yisrael? The halachas of the sota, the following sota, the procedure is totally voluntary, okay? But it is the following. A husband, with good reason, to become very insecure about his wife's loyalty, has warned her not to be secluded with such and such a person, okay? Because he's concerned. He feels, he has reason to believe that she's not being loyal to him, okay? So he's warned her, do not be secluded alone, yichud, with such and such a person. After that warning, okay, that specific warning, she goes ahead and in front of two witnesses, she secludes herself in a closed, locked room with no windows or the window shades drawn with this person. Now, nobody knows what happens in that room. That's the problem. Maybe she was contaminated, so to speak. In other words, maybe it was consummated, maybe it wasn't. The problem is that the Baal, the husband, is in a bind. The halacha is he cannot live with her if she has violated the basic red, you know, crossed that red line and has consummated a relationship with someone else. So he has many options. He can divorce her. But this is a case where he doesn't want to. He wants to restore the marriage, but he's not allowed to. He's stuck. Even if she says she's not allowed to incriminate herself. That's another problem. So this is a case where she has to not want a divorce, or she can ask for a divorce, in which case Beis Din will make him give it to her. But she wants to be married, despite the fact that she's acted in a way that is really a betrayal of trust. He would like to be married. This is the case. The problem is they can't be together unless the trust is restored. The way the trust is restored is they have to go to a Kohen. They have to go to the Mishkan. Just like you have to give the money to the Kohen if you don't know who to return it to, you have to go to the Kohen. And what the Kohen will do is put her through an embarrassing situation. We will talk about that. But if she's innocent, which is the only way a woman would ever agree to undergo this, because if she's not innocent, she'll ask for a get and be finished. Because if she's not innocent, you know what happens with the waters of the Sota, right? The same thing that happened when they also betrayed Hashem by the Chet HaEgel, which is Arias and Avodah Zarah is always the same mushal. Arias and Avodah Zarah is the same mushal. So what happened when they committed Gilui Arias, so to speak? In other words, they betrayed Hashem by the Egel. They also had to drink the waters. And a very bizarre and supernatural death. Their bellies bloated up and they died. So the point here is, if she's guilty, she will not agree to undergo this. She'll just ask for a get. But if she's not guilty, and she regrets, and they both want to restore the marriage, she will undergo this procedure. And there will be bizayon attached to it, obviously, it's a humiliation, more or equally for the husband. What husband wants to do this? Okay, what husband wants to bring his wife to this, and everybody hears about it, right? So, it's an unfortunate experience. The husband, in a sense, is a little bit implicated that this happened. He also undergoes embarrassment. And there's all kinds of conditions. If she did a lot of mitzvahs, the water doesn't work. And if the guy, and all kinds of things. But anyway, they erase the Shem HaMeforesh in the waters of the Sota. Hashem's own name. It's the Chilul Hashem. Hashem's own name is erased just to restore. In other words, Hashem will endure. A Chilul Hashem, an erasure of his name, just to restore shalom between the husband and the wife. And if she was innocent, and hello, innocent doesn't mean squeaky clean. If she didn't consummate the marriage, if the last second she got a hold of herself, then she's blessed with blessings of children and all kinds of things for undergoing the bizayon that she went through, even though she kind of brought it on herself. These are the laws of sota. Okay, very interesting laws. We'll talk about them in more depth. What are they doing here? What's their relationship to the one before, Gezel Hager? And then, of course, after Sota, you come to Nazir. Nazir has a clear smichas to Sota, a relationship. It's a clear segue. The Nazir is the one that sees the Sota and says, I am not letting this happen to me. I am not going to allow myself to get into this predicament. But wait a second. She's a woman. The Nazir is a man. So he's not going to let himself get into a predicament where there you can you know, cross or almost cross those lines. So he withholds from himself wine and physical. He doesn't groom himself. And there's a machlokus if this is a mila, a good thing or a bad thing. In the end, he brings a korban chatos because he restricted from himself that which the Torah permits. But it's the recognition that the people become afraid that they could really mess up. They could really mess up, and they want to try to assume precautions not to mess up. And then following that is Birchas Kohanim, which we'll talk about. And after that is the 12 Nesiim bringing their gifts to the Mishkan, which really happened back in Parsha Shmini, back in Vayikra, you know, it's already mentioned. And why is it brought back, mentioned again here? The Nesiim are not mentioned, but the Chanukas HaMishkan is already mentioned. Why not mention the gifts of the Nesiim back then? So we have a whole bunch of laws stuck in here, in Parshas Naso. What are they doing here? That's the question. Okay, so what we're going to try to do is create a thematic connection between them, and then we'll understand what they're doing here right before we get ready to go into Eretz Yisrael. In order to begin to understand all of these things, we are going to go back to a fundamental idea, which we must have clarity on. And I'm going to introduce today a new angle to this idea. And if it seems wild and abstract, we'll be talking about it, we'll be building it, we'll be securing this idea, we'll be anchoring this idea. We're just going to start to think about it. We're going to start to hear these words, these new words, these new ideas. And they will, as you know, everyone who's been coming here for a while knows that with time and with, you know, things build upon themselves. So the idea we have to go to here are the ideas that are what we call Omed Barom Moshel Olam, the most fundamental ideas. We're going back to the big question. Let's talk about the biggest question of all the questions, okay? It's really the explanation of the first pasuk in Bereishis. You know, man forever has been contemplating the mystery of existence. How did we get here? Our origins, our cause, and our purpose. Okay, we have a specific mahalach on this. Judaism has a very specific approach on this. Okay, we're going to start with the basic question. We know Bereishis bara Elokim. Look, if there's a whole world here and it has a purpose, you would expect the Torah to give us some type of glimpse of understanding of that purpose, right? And the Torah does. It's the beginning. It's the whole story of Bereishis. It's all the creation chapters. It's the whole story of everything prior to, you know, real history. It's all the Sheshes Mei Bereishis. Okay. So it's answering the big question. Why are we here? What's it all about? How does it work? So Bereishis bara. Bara, everybody knows that the word bara means in the beginning of creation, right? That's Bereishis. Bara Elokim. Elokim created. Everybody knows that Bria is not what we normally think about when we talk about creation. When we think in human terms of creation, we're thinking of Yetzira, forming something from something, taking a block of clay and making it into a vase. But Bria, everybody knows, is Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothing. Here's the big question that all the Mekubalim and all the philosophers and Jews and Jewish and not Jewish deal with, but this is a specifically Jewish approach. What does Yesh Me'ayin mean? Something from nothing. How could there be a nothing? What does nothing mean? What preceded the existing universe? Adon Olam Asher Malach B'Terem Kol Yetzir Nivra. So what was here? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's not Ayin. That's rather what we call Ein Sof, the infinite, the opposite of Ayin, the limitless, the totality. Everything that that later came to exist is just an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that pre-existed everything. By the way, that Hashem pre-existed everything was proven by the Nisim. You see, Spinozian pantheism says that nature, the totality of nature, in all its enormity and complexity, that is God. But Judaism says, no, it is not God, because God can interfere with it and manipulate it and change it. Therefore, he's not bound by it. Therefore, he's not the same as nature. Therefore, he created nature, he pre-existed nature. So we say Hashem existed, Hashem must exist before Bria, the Bria came into existence. So that's not Ayin, that's not nothing. That's the opposite of nothing. That's infinite everything. And this world is just a limited, finite, temporary expression of that. This world is the nothing, the temporary. But that's the yesh. So Mekubalim have to explain to us, and Bali Machshava, the philosophers, have to explain to us, where did the ayin come from? Where did the nothing come from? That's a fundamental question. So we now say that the nothing, the ayin that we're speaking about, was created by Hashem. Okay? That's what Bria means. Bria means Hashem created an ayin, a nothing, within which he could create something. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean? It's not so complicated, but it's very logical, just a step by step. In other words, if Hashem is the Ein Sof, the limitless, infinite everything from which anything that ever existed comes from, okay? How is it possible that when Hashem brought this world into existence, how is it possible that his existence, his infinite presence, did not pervade the Bria that he created, so that the entire Bria is intensely aware of its creator, of the presence of its creator, and of being existing because of the will, the ongoing, clear, obvious, ever-present, all-pervasive will of the creator? How is it possible that creation doesn't know the one that's creating it? Here's the mashal. How is it possible, and yet this is the mashal Hashem gave us, so we know it's true, that the fetus has never seen its mother in the womb, doesn't know who its mother is, can't come face to face with it, has no idea who its mother is. Only after it goes through the womb, which the Mishnah and the Gemara calls the kever, does it finally come face to face with its mother. Right? A baby only after birth is now comes face to face with its mother. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how created a world that the creations, we, are not aware of our constant, every millisecond of our life, and every breath we take, and every thought we think, and everything that exists is the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the ever-present, animation. Hashem brings it into being, maintains its being. How is it that that is not obvious? If Hashem is Ein Sof, how could the Bria not even be aware he exists, right? If all of the Bria comes from that. So what we're saying is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to create, so to speak, a reality in here, okay, that we perceive in our heads, that he is not present. Otherwise, there'd be no what? There'd be no free choice. In other words, when we say Bereishis Bara, what the Mekubalim call tzimtzum, withdrawal or contraction, and we call, let's say, Hester Panim, okay, or Choshech, that's the Choshech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to create, what is perceived by us to be a world, a space, so to speak, not a physical space, devoid of Hashem's obvious presence. Otherwise, the human beings and everything that would exist in it would be so pervaded by the obvious presence of Hashem, we would be sucked up into, so to speak, Hashem's sphere. We'd have no bechira. We would be part of it. So Hashem is what they call mitzamtzem, contracts, so to speak, or withdraws, and or hides. And what's left after that is what we call a choshech. In here, a choshech. We perceive a choshech, that there's no R, because Hashem's Ein Sof is also called the R Ein Sof, the light, so to speak. Right? That we are living now with a perception that this space is a cholol, devoid of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So far, so good? Otherwise, there's no Bechira. Okay? Now, remember we said that when Hashem withdraws, so to speak, his presence and leaves a choshech, within which now, that's the ayin, that's the nothing, the perceived nothing, within which he could create a world that imagines itself to have free choice and be separate from Hashem. Okay? Hashem, when he withdraws, that choshech is not a passive, empty choshech. It's a dynamic, empty space. Remember, we have another word for this. When you blow up a balloon into sand, and then you let the air out of the balloon, okay, what's left is an impression. That is called, in the words of Balei Machshava, right, a roshem. a roshim. It leaves an impression, okay? The impression that is left means that you know something was here. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu withdrew his obvious presence, but the impression that that leaves in all of us and in the entire Bria is we know something was here and it's missing and we will never be satisfied till we drag it, draw it back down, okay? That is Hebrew. The Hebrew words for that is kolsa nafshi, right? The shorish is kol. Vayachulu hashamayim v'haaretz. The word used for that is that Hashem, after He created this world, embedded in this world, vayachulu hashamayim v'haaretz means, in a deeper level, not just that Hashem finished, but that Hashem fulfilled this whole world with an intuitive sense of kolsa nafshi, like a kala. A kala is a woman who goes to the chuppah, there is a void that needs to be filled, correct? And it should be filled, and when it's filled, there's creation comes from that. So the whole Bria, and it's on a microscopic level, it's in viruses and bacteria and on cells, the way things work is amino acids bonding with spaces or voids in the cell, in different parts of the cells to create reactions. It's in every part of the Bria, and we feel it in here, something's missing. Now, so that is Bereshis Bara. Bara means Hashem withdrew. Okay, this is the Yechidish. Bara by us means Hashem withdrew His obvious pervasive Shechina so that there could be a perceived empty space. Okay, that is called Choshech, but it's really not Choshech, only from our perspective, just like the mother knows who the fetus is. And the mother is taking care of the fetus, but the fetus is, so to speak, enveloped in Choshech and doesn't see the mother. Okay, and that choshech, okay, that into that choshech Hashem said by he or, in other words, he allowed some of the or to pervade that choshech, and that is of course what we feel, and that's of course some nisim and nevuah and all of those things, and our ha'arasenayim, our enlightenment, that we, the or comes in, and our job is to pull more and more of that or back into the so-called empty space. Now here. Here's the thing. Next. So far, so good? Okay. So now, the fact that there's choshech, okay, creates a innate tension and an innate arena of what we call avodas Hashem. If there would be no choshech, there'd be no bechira. But the point of our yiras Hashem and our yiras Shemaim is to fill that choshech up with or. If we succeed in pulling in so much R that there's no more Choshech, then that means we have no more Bechira. So embedded in the Avodas Hashem, or the Yira Shemaim that a person has to avoid, to extricate themselves, to lighten up the darkness, is already a knowledge that if all that darkness is light, there is no Bechira and there's no more Avodas Hashem anyway. You see that? Everybody knows that we live... No, it's not that. It's that the tension of avodas Hashem is, of serving Hashem, is to not succumb to the darkness and view it as a metzias, as a reality, but to try to draw the light into the darkness. But Hashem sets up a world that's never totally possible. Like you can never utterly succeed, because then the purpose of this world is no longer met, which is that a person is using their efforts to fill the darkness with light. Okay, now, here we are introduced. Now, this idea we've spoken about, right? It sounds more familiar a little bit. Now we're introducing another idea, and hopefully we might have to go over a few minutes, bring it back to the halachos. We are introducing a new idea, okay? The juggler and the king. Okay, now, Rabbi Kaminsky is trying to get hold of more copies. Or you can buy them on Amazon for $100. Okay? You're new. But he's trying to get more copies. So the juggling king. So there is a pasuk. There is a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Okay? And this ends up in the Sabe de Beatuna. Remember? Sabe de Beatuna are the elders of Athens, the masters of Greek wisdom, in the time already of the Roman Empire, but they still had their autonomous Greek academies. And they were asked by the Caesar to debate with different cases different people, but this is one of the people that the Caesar sent. It was Hold on one second. I don't want to misquote the person who the Caesar, who the person of the Caesar sent to debate with them. It was not Rabbi Bar Bachana. Hold on one second. Anyway, one of the what happens is the Caesar says to, I think it's Rabbi Yeshua. He says to him the following. He says, "The Sabe de Beyatuna." Okay. The Sabe de Beyatuna. Hold on one second. The Caesar says to them, the Sabe de Beatuna have a question. They say, the question is, how long is a snake pregnant? Okay? So the Caesar said that the Sabe de Beatuna said that a snake is pregnant for 3 years. Okay? I think it's Rabbi Yeshua answers and says, nope, it's 7 years. So the Caesar says, well, they tried it. I have it right here, actually. Sorry. They tried it, and here we go. Oh yeah, Rav Shua ben Chananya. Amar lo Kesar, Rabbi Shua ben Chananya. The Kesar, the Caesar says, Rav Shua ben Chananya. How many years is a snake pregnant? He says for 7. So he says, but the Sabe de Beatuna say it's only 3. So Rav Shua ben Chananya said they took a snake that's already pregnant. So he says, they're the smart people. He says, I'm smarter than them. Okay. What is this talking about? He says, if that's the case, go debate them and overcome them. So Caesar sends Rav Shua ben Chananya to debate them. What is this talking about? So in order to understand the concept of how long is a snake pregnant, and we are not even going to go into the whole thing. We're just going to talk about the snake and the snake being pregnant. Okay. But the 7 years and the 3 years we're not going to talk about. But what does it mean a snake and how long is it pregnant and it's already, and Yeshua ben Chanan is saying it's already pregnant. They took a snake that's already pregnant. Okay. So in Yeshayahu, speaking about the end of days, okay, there's a very bizarre pasuk. It refers to the snakes, especially the tannin. Remember the tannin that was created before man? The great creatures of the sea, which is not meant to be taken literally. Rashi has a perish there, which you know isn't literal. There was a male and a female, Liv Yasson, and Hashem saw they would destroy the world, so Hashem slaughtered the female and salted it for the tzaddikim, la'asid lavo. When you start hearing that stuff, you know it's not literal, and you're dealing with, you know, the biggest, you know, most profound Kabbalistic ideas. So in Yeshayahu, it says that in the end of days, I'll quote it to you in English. It's Perek Chaf Zayin Pasuk Aleph. On that day, in the future, God, with his hard, great, and mighty sword, will judge the Leviathan, the outstretched snake, and the Leviathan, the coiled snake, and he will slay the serpent in the sea. Yeshayahu makes reference to an outstretched snake and a coiled snake. Okay? These are important ideas, because they represent two types of forces that a human being experiences or is tempted by. One is referred to as the outstretched snake. One is referred to as the coiled snake. Now, in the end of days, they will be destroyed. Now, whenever we're speaking about the nachash, the outstretched nachash, and the coiled nachash, okay, we're going back to the Eitz Hadas, to the Nachash. Okay, we're even going back earlier to the Tanin, but leave that. We're going back to the Eitz Hadas. The Nachash comes in two forms, to tempt a person, to tempt the Isha, outstretched and coiled. Okay? Let's first understand the uniqueness of the Nachash in the Sabe de Beatuna, that it took a pregnant snake and therefore they didn't realize it. So, the Rogachover. You heard about the Rogachover? If you Google the Rogachover, you will see a picture of a very interesting-looking man. He was a huge genius, whose hair was literally all over the place, like this, like a very interesting person. Genius of geniuses. Learned by Rav Chaim Brisker. Died in 1936. Okay. The Rogachover learned the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim, and in Safnas Paneach, and this is all thanks to Heshi Wien, he speaks about this subject. And he explains that the Nachash represents a force in the world, which is part of the fabric of the world, and it's part of the Choshech. Nachash and Choshech go together a lot, right? They share two similar letters. Because of this Choshech, because of this perceived void where Hashem is not present, we don't seem to perceive Hashem, although we are living like the fetus, completely, off the goodwill of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but in our minds it's not obvious, and therefore we think we have free choice. This free choice expresses itself in two ways: the coiled snake, two types of nachash, temptations, and the stretched out snake. So the Ragachover says the following: that every single creature, by nature, okay, chukasav mugderet, its chuka, its desires, its ambition, its interests is limited strictly to what it needs for survival. It eats till it's satisfied. It copulates when it's mating season. It kills if it's in danger or if it's hungry. It just does what it needs to survive. When it secures its survival, its chuka, its desire, is no longer there. It doesn't exist anymore. Other than the nachash. The nachash, he says, is the only, brings us down, the only bria. That when the female is pregnant, she will still copulate. In other words, what this is saying is, she will do something strictly for pleasure that has no connection or purpose or productive value for her tachlis, for her survival. In other words, if the mitzias, the reality is existence, every single thing that the animals do is for their existence. Other than the nachash, which represents two things, the coiled snake represents the force in a person that will do something that has no benefit for their existence at all, not in any way aiding or increasing or enhancing their existence or ensuring their survival, strictly for physical gratification or pleasure of one sort or another that has nothing to do with their real purpose here. The reason it's called the coiled snake, he explains in The Juggler and the King, is that this temptation coils itself, so to speak, around the person and squeezes them so hard. In other words, it surrounds a person and controls a person until it destroys the person. Okay? It overcomes a person. That's one type of temptation. But the nachash also, unlike any other animal he brings down, will bite when not in danger, when not for any productive purposes, just to destroy, just to kill. Just to bite and to kill. Which means that in addition, there's another temptation that we have, which is not to ignore, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because we're just consumed with our own pleasure, so therefore we forget about the tachlis, what we're here for, but to actually go out aggressively, that's called the outstretched snake, and destroy the tachlis. In other words, if there is a purpose for us, we go and undermine it. We try to ruin it, right? Try to make sure that it's not known and it's not served. That's killing for the sake of killing. Now, human beings are the only creature, symbolized by the nachash, that has these features. We pursue, invest tons of energy in something that has nothing to do with our purpose or help our survival at all. In fact, could be destructive in the end to our survival. And furthermore, and Freud talks about this, he talks about these two forces too. He also talks about a death wish, that people will do things to their own detriment, eventually committing suicide. You don't find this in the animal kingdom. This will be strictly for their detriment, to destroy their existence. They will do things that are completely disconnected from their existence, and they will do things that destroy. It's the opposite of survival of the fittest. You do not find that in the animal kingdom, where you try to destroy yourself. Okay? All of nature is governed by survival. Okay? And this is the opposite. Now, these two forces are outcomes of the Choshech. Into the Choshech, the forces, in other words, the dangers of the Choshech is the Nachash, which is that because we do not perceive Hashem's presence here, and we've spoken about this from many different angles, we believe that our little world is the whole world, and it's about me in taking care of myself. We've spoken about giving kavod to ourselves, putting the crown on our own head, right? And we do things that, because of lack of clarity, are self-indulgent, in the end, destructive. And we even try to destroy the metzias, the truth itself, like Esav, Makiras Boro, he recognized Hashem, Umischavin Limrobo, and tried purposefully to destroy him, to rebel against him. Okay? There are enemies here in our world, snakes, so to speak. Hitler Yimach Shemo, he said the Jews are the conscience of mankind. He didn't want to hear. He wanted to destroy anything that spoke of a metzias, of a truth, of a purpose, of a tachlis. Okay? That's the dangers of the chosha. Now, these dangers are inherent because if the light pervaded the darkness, again, there'd be no bechira. This is explaining that these are the two types of forces or temptations of how we get lost in the darkness. We don't want to know about the tachlis and the metzias, and we willfully push it away, or we just ignore it. So the way he says it here is that either there is man refusing to subordinate himself to any will but his own, which is to the outstretched snake, to destroy the concept that there's another greater truth, or there is a tendency to ignore God's will and just become involved in satisfying your pleasures, which is the so-called coiled snake, okay? This is the introduction of this idea, which you'll hear about more. And these are the ways that we get lost in the choshech, okay? And we never make it into the light. Now let's take this idea and relate it to traveling to Eretz Yisrael, okay? Traveling to Eretz Yisrael means arriving at that place where we are in the right place with clarity. Hashem's hashgacha is upon us. We see it. We're devoting ourselves to that. But before we get there, there's a few halachas here that are comparable to what we just said, okay? You have the halach of Gezel Hager. So the Rambam, in the opening to the laws of tshuva, okay, chooses, instead of the pasuk, there's an open pasuk that you shall return to Hashem. V'shavta ad Hashem alokecha. He doesn't use that pasuk as his first proof text why you have to do tshuva. He says, he starts opening Hilchos tshuva with, kisha yasa adam tshuva. When a person does tshuva, he doesn't even say, if a person chooses to do tshuva. He says, kisha yasa adam tshuva. He says a person sins, and kisha yasa adam tshuva, when a person will do tshuva, like it's inevitable. He's chayav to be misvada, he has to say vidoy. What does he bring as a proof text? This pasuk in Naso. Okay? So he starts out, if a person does any of the sins, kisha yasa tshuva, when he will do tshuva, he has to do vidoy, and he brings this pasuk. Why is he bringing the pasuk from Gezel Hager? And there are other psukim he could have chosen, okay? And he's focusing on vidoy. So the Chedushei Harim says, in relationship to, he asks a question about the first day and the second day kriya on Rosh Hashanah. The first day is Hashem Pakad Esara. The second day is Akedas Yitzchak, okay? What do the two have to do with each other? The word Pakad is the shorish of the word Pikadon. Hashem gave Sarah a pikadon. What's a pikadon? Something on loan. That's the first day. What did he give Sarah on loan? Yitzchak. What happens the second day, Kriya of Akedas Yitzchak? He asked for it back. So the Chedushei Harim says, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu invests a neshama into every person. That's Rosh Hashanah. That's Hashem Pakad Sarah. And at some point, Hashem will ask for it back. That's called tshuva. When the neshama returns to its creator, that's called tshuva. It's inevitable. It's going to happen to everybody. Kisha yasa adam tshuva. Rambam, the Chiddush Rambam is saying, you know what Rambam is alluding to here by using this pasuk? The same as a person who has in his possession valuables that really don't belong to him. And he has declared that they're his, that he owes nothing to anyone, that nobody's possessions are deposited with him, right? He's acted treacherously. He's claimed that these valuables are his, and he could do with them what he wants, right? That person is going to have to return them, and he has to add a fifth, okay? And he says this is a mushel. Rambam's using this pasuk because it's the perfect mushel. What do we have with us that doesn't belong to us, and we refuse to acknowledge its rightful owner, and we misuse it, me'ila, and we use it for all the wrong things? our neshama, our life force, our life itself. We Hashem has invested us with life, and because of the choshech, because of the fact that Hashem is concealed, which allows us to have free choice, we don't search for Hashem. We ignore Hashem. That's right beyond the darkness, and it's only darkness to us. The mother sees the fetus. The fetus is living in this little bubble of darkness, so to speak, that it doesn't know its mother, right? Although it hears her heart rate, and it's being carried from place to place, and it's being kept warm, and it's being cushioned, and it's living off her nutrients. I mean, there's a lot of signs that there's a mother out there. But it's in a womb, so it doesn't see the mother, so it pretends that there isn't any, right? So that's when we have a nefesh and a ruach and a neshama, and we declare that no, it's ours, and we can do with it what we want, and it is not anyone else's. But Rambam says, Kisha yasa adam tshuva. You know what? That every adam is going to do tshuva. Everyone's neshama is going to go back, return to Hashem. And therefore, while we're alive, we must admit vidoy. We must admit that, you know what? We must come to our senses. We must recognize that at a certain point we have to say, yes, we have something that doesn't belong to us and we're not allowed to misuse it, and we have to use it correctly and even improve it, add a chomesh, even give it back eventually better than we got it. So the first concept of Gezel Hager, okay, the first danger is the coiled snake. Total ignoring that there's even a Kodesh Baruch Hu out there, and the temptation called the Nachash to just indulge in our own pleasures for our own sake, and ignore the fact and not search for what is the source of all the things we have and what are we supposed to be doing with them. Okay? However, Sota, the next topic, could be compared to the outstretched snake in Yeshayahu. Okay? That is, we said, the Nachash that is aware. In other words, the person is aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The woman has a husband, okay? And the husband has signed on the dotted line in the ksuva, food, clothing, shelter, and relations. He's committed. He's bound. He's loyal. He wants to be married to her. And she, despite the fact, this is Klal Yisrael, right? This is a human being, goes ahead and does everything that can destroy the trust, betray, undermine, and basically declare, I have no loyalty to you. You're bound to me. You're committed to me. There's no get. But I am not, I'm going to take advantage of it. And I'm going to do what I want. And I'm not going to have any regard for your expectations of me or your rights as your that you have as being my husband. That is an outright, so to speak, mi'ila, same word, act of treachery. And that's the second type of temptation. A person says, I don't care about my obligations. In fact, I'm going to act as if I don't have any. And I'm going to undermine them publicly. All right? That's really what it is. Now, in the case of the Sota, which the Mashal is Hashem and Klal Yisrael, the husband, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, wants the relationship to continue. Okay, now, so does she. When she realizes what she's done and she sees that the whole thing is in danger of being just lost forever, she also wants the marriage to continue. And what happens is she's subjected to bizayon. Now, embarrassment. Now, the embarrassment, whenever we speak about, okay, any type of onesh, really, in the next world, okay, gehenim, fire, okay, we're speaking about humiliation, the embarrassment. Now, Rav Moshe Shapiro explains, and by the way, Mirtz Hashem, we're not going to be here next week because, you know, Mirtz Hashem, we'll be in Amsterdam with Rav Moshe Shapiro and hearing more good stuff. And so he explains the following in his Sefer Re'ei Emuna. He explains that when we speak about Gehenim or as fire or bizarre embarrassment, it's like this. Because we're in this choshech, okay, which the light can penetrate. It really can. There's Hashem vayihiyar. Hashem penetrated a lot of light in this choshech. You got to blind yourself to not see it, okay? But what happens is when we do blind ourselves, what we do is we live in a reality that we ourselves have invented and it doesn't involve Hashem, and it doesn't involve obligations to Hashem, and it doesn't involve Hashem's desire to have a relationship with us. This is our own fantasy land we live in, and where we could do anything. Okay? And when a person lives in a fantasy, in a delusion, that moment where the bubble is burst, where that so-called reality doesn't exist anymore, when all of a sudden, in one second, what we thought was reality was all a fantasy, that moment is called fire, because fire destroys something substantial, something tangible that used to be here and now it's gone. And fire also is the embarrassment, the redness, our delusion, our bubble is burst. In other words, the mashal for this is what? The ultimate mashal in the Chumash? The Acha Yosef. As soon as he said, Ani Yosef, their whole delusionary world of 22 years and everything they did because of their imaginary realities, they saw didn't exist. It was all only in their own heads. And here was Yosef sitting on the throne, and everything and the suffering they caused. And this is the fire, so to speak. So she is subject to an embarrassment, a bursting of the bubble of her imagined reality. But that restores the relationship, and then they're blessed, and that restores our relationship with Hashem. And following this comes the Nazir. Now we have to get into another idea, and it's just going to take, I'm going to introduce it, but we're going to come back to it again. Everyone has 5 more minutes? What does the Nazir do? The Nazir sees these two, sees the Sota, but in the sequence here, it's coming after these two sins, right? Gezel, Hager, and Sota. The Nazir is the human being that sees the dangers of the Choshech and how we could live in a bubble, banish all the R, and imagine that it's all about our own pleasures, the coiled snake, right? Just, misuse everything Hashem has given us for our own interests. Or the even maybe more, fearful danger, which is to willfully banish the truth from ourselves and fight against it and undermine it. And in both these cases, what could happen if it goes unchecked is the person never fulfills the tachlis of their creation. Because the whole point of Bechira is so that we should be the ones that draw that light back, not that we should be the ones that forget there's light and push it even further away. So the Nazir says, this is too dangerous. I'm not going to allow myself to fall into this trap, period. So he goes and restricts from himself any wines or grooming or anything that's going to make him, God forbid, get caught in the trap. But in the end, this is not what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants either, and he brings the Korban Chatas, right? So here we have an idea, okay? And this is an idea from Rav Huttner, okay? It's in the volume on the Maimarim and the volume of Shabbos and Sukkos in the back, Maimar Yutes 19. It's famous. Rav Huttner says that that you remember the famous argument between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. They had a big argument, a philosophical debate. Mutav lo la'adam shelo nivra, right? Or mutav lo la'adam shelo nivra. Is it better had a person ever been created versus a person being created? And what happened? They counted, whatever that means, and they concluded it's better a person never been created. Okay? But now that we're here, the person should do their best, right? And should always try to do the right thing. What is this argument, mutav lo shelo nivra? In other words, considering the dangers, okay, of the choshech, you might want to say, mutav lo la'adam shelo nivra. It's better had we not been created. Who can successfully navigate the choshech? Right? So that would be your first argument. But the fact is, Hashem said, at the end of Bria Sa'adam, Hashem said, Tov Ma'od. And Ma'od, just flip around the letters, Adam. It's not just Tov, it's Tov Ma'od. So how could it be Mutav Shelo Nivra? Get it, right? Big question? So Rav Huttner answers by comparing Yitzchak to Yaakov. I'm not going to go into all the details, but he says that Yitzchak, as we know, he's ready to give up his whole life, and he does give it up in his kavana, not physically, but in his heart and soul, he gave it up to Hashem. And Yitzchak represents, we said, the person that recognizes that it's not worth living in this world. This whole world is only for to create an attachment to Hashem, and if that attachment means giving up everything in this world, he's willing to give up everything. Yitzchak is mutav shelo nivra. In other words, this world is, it's worth giving up all life, because the only tachlis is our attachment to Hashem, and therefore, Yitzchak, in a sense, his midas, you know, is discipline and gavura. He does not want to allow himself to get trapped, to get attached to anything, to be pulled into anything which might in any way interfere his connection to Hashem. So he holds back from everything. He restrains from everything. He doesn't want to engage in the world. Followed by Yaakov, okay, who's fully engaged in the world. And by Yaakov is the opposite of Yitzchak, because it says by Yaakov it was established the following principle. Yisrael, afilo shechata Yisrael. Even if you get involved in the world and you get trapped in the choshech, and because of that you sin for either of the reasons, you're still Yisrael, because you can do tshuva. Don't worry about it. Okay? You're still Yisrael. You can do tshuva. You're not excluded from Klal Yisrael. You're not rejected. You're not banished. You're not struck down by lightning. Don't worry. So, Rav Huner explains, the only way it's safe to live and engage in the world despite the dangers is if preceding your feeling of Mutav lo shla adam shenivra, tov ma'od, it's good, is first you go through the stage of clear awareness of mutav lo la adam shelo nivra. First, you have to be fully cognizant of the dangers of being entrapped by this world, by the choshech. And when you're aware of them, and you're cautious of them, and you create for yourself a life that helps you avoid the traps, then you can be trusted to enter the world and live, and if you sin, there's tshuva. But if you just jump in without the necessary reverence and fear and awareness of the dangers, you're lost. First, you have to have a healthy, like Yitzchak, awareness of the dangers of living and engaging in the world. Then you move on to be, then you can be trusted, so to speak, to live. So the Nazir represents, he's like in a sense, like Yitzchak. I don't want to even go near it. It's too dangerous. What comes after the Nazir? Birchas Kohanim. Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. Hashem should give you bracha of everything. But Hashem should help you be shomer, guard you. Guard you from what? Rashi says you should have a lot of wealth, but the thieves shouldn't steal it. Which you can interpret philosophically. You say Hashem should give you everything. So that there's so much to utilize in this world, but it should not be stolen from you. How is it stolen? It could be easily appropriated in the wrong way, either by the Gezel Hager, by forgetting that it's all here for a tachlis, and saying, I'm a free agent, I owe nothing to nobody, or by the Sota, which is an obvious, clear, you know, kind of like active, you know, declaration of war almost against HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is wants a relationship and is providing everything, and refusal to commit to that. That's really the Sota concept. So Rashi says that you should have a lot and that it shouldn't be taken from you. The way it's taken from us is ourselves, falling into either of these two traps called the Nachash, or two types of Nachash, which in the end will be slaughtered, which means we'll no longer fall into these traps, because in the end, the light will pervade the darkness and it'll all be so clear, and we'll realize that the darkness was only for us darkness, not a real darkness, a created darkness. Nachash becomes Mashiach. Very, very, very true. And by the way, in Sabbath Be'atuna, the 7 years and the 3 years, it's all about Mashiach. And by the way, the father of Mashiach is Yishai, which is Yesh, Me'ayin. There's a lot more to talk about this, but keep this in mind, review it, and we will revisit these ideas. Have a wonderful, everybody, wait 1 second. If you're not on the email in the office, put your name on the email in the office so you'll know when there's no class.
Which you shot it, which,